the case of Quinn against Wexford Health Sources.
May it please the court. My name is Jared Casaglad on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Brenda Quinn as administrator of the estate of her son, Travis Fredrickson, and I've requested 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I'm here to plead with this court to reverse the decision granting summary judgment to defendants Rodman, Hammersley, and Wexford Health Sources. I'm going to start with defendant Rodman. The undisputed facts are that, according to the prisoner witnesses, that Mr. Fredrickson complained to Mr. Rodman, or a guard, expressing suicidal feelings, calling out for help, and otherwise asking to see mental health practitioners.
So let me just jump in right away. The district court, and certainly the state argues, that while there was testimony from some of these other prisoners on his block, it was actually not as concise as you just characterized it. It didn't say, I heard inmate so-and-so, I heard, you know, Mr. Fredrickson ask Mr. Rodman for psych help. It's much vaguer. You know, there at some point somebody's yelling, at some point people are hearing things, but whether it's said to C.O. Rodman or not is quite unclear, and that concerned the district court because there wasn't enough to trigger Rodman's responsibility to respond.
Sure, I'll address that first. So Rodman admits that he interacted with Mr. Fredrickson during the 10 p.m. count, during which time these prisoners claim that Mr. Fredrickson was expressing these kinds of feelings.
But what does interacted mean? I mean, does it mean he went to the front of the cell the way he was supposed to, or does it mean he said, I'm in here and fine, or I'm in here and I'm not fine? You know, what does it mean? Interacted is pretty broad.
It means that he spoke with him, and that's what he admits. And what was exchanged during that interaction is a subject of a classic factual dispute, because the prisoners claim at that time he was calling out for help loudly, and Rodman says he heard nothing like that. So
I don't know that the prisoners are that precise in their timing. That's what worries me. I mean, obviously, it's a very sad case, and there's no doubt about that. But connecting what the prisoners were saying to what Rodman heard is essential before we can hold Rodman responsible for not taking further steps, you know, to address somebody's distress.
And against the record evidence, you know, Rodman suggests that, well, maybe he didn't hear it. Maybe he was in a different part of the cell when he was making, or the prison when he was making these complaints. Maybe it was too loud for him to hear.
Do we know how big this general area is that Rodman was responsible for monitoring?
I don't think that's in the record, but in our view, that's not material because he admits that he interacted and spoke with him at the 10 p.m. count when the prisoners claim Mr. Fredrickson was interacting with him. And the reason that I think, you know, the district court's problem with the vagueness of the testimony was that she was unable from the record to determine the exact words that some of these prisoners used. And that was occasioned by the fact that the prisoners were not deposed in the case. And so their testimony was not officially made of record. And if it was vague and the district court didn't know or wasn't sure what testimony was, you know, we suggest that means the defendants didn't meet their burden to show their entitlement to summary judgment in the first place.
Well, Mr. Kosick, Mr. Kosick, it's not just what was said, it was when it was said, correct? Because we don't necessarily have any record evidence that says that the statements being made by Mr. Fredrickson was at the same time that Mr. Rodman was present, nor do we have record evidence that says the prisoners overhearing such statements by Mr. Fredrickson occurred when Mr. Rodman was around. So it's not just what was said, when was said, correct?
That's correct. I mean, obviously, if he's making complaints to an empty space and Rodman's not there to hear it, then Rodman's not liable. But again, like, you know, our view is that these kinds of issues are factual disputes based on the record. And I think that the affidavit of Michael Williams, and again, I haven't memorized it, but does say that it was during the 10 p.m. count. But even if he doesn't, the fact that Rodman is the guard on duty and for all intents and purposes, the only record evidence is that he's in the general area where these prisoners are held. If they're going to come out and deny that the reason he didn't, that it was some other guard who was there or responsible, there's no evidence any other guards were in this area at the time. The only evidence of any guard being there is Rodman. So the only guard it could have been was Rodman. And obviously, you know, if there's going to be some kind of dispute over whether he heard it or not because he wasn't there, you know, there's no facts to support that. So
let me put it in a procedural way for you. The defendants move for summary judgment. They're entitled under the Celotex framework simply to point to a gap in your side, certainly in Ms. Quinn's side or Mr. Frederickson's side, that is an essential element. And if you can't show it, then you can't win. So they don't have a burden of introducing evidence necessarily, since they don't have the burden of proof on this point. And the question then becomes whether Ms. Quinn, acting for Mr. Frederickson, has put enough in the record that a rational jury could say, well, we have an issue here. You know, was there a conversation about mental distress going on between Frederickson and Rodman or not? And the problem is that this may fall short. Even if he's banging on his cell door, did Rodman hear him? Was he in the area? How big was the unit? How many other people were there? What time, as Judge Brennan points out, you know, did this all happen? So that's what at least has me concerned about this. So from a procedural point of view, have you gotten beyond that first step when the defendants move for summary judgment? They say, we don't think you can link up this communication with Rodman. And if Rodman has no idea, then he can't be liable. And then what do you come back with?
Right. And so I think that what we come back with is what I've already stated, and yeah, I don't need to repeat it.
No, you don't.
And the fact that, you know, and the fact that, again, they chose not to depose these witnesses, and then, you know, they didn't really claim in the district court that there were ambiguities.
But why
that the court's describing.
Why was it their problem? Why was it the state's problem to depose these witnesses? Actually,
because they're the ones.
Mr. Frederickson, his mother, needs. They don't have the burden of proof. That's what I'm trying to be clear about.
I'm sorry.
No, go on.
Yeah, and at trial, that's correct. You know, at trial, we've disclosed witnesses we intend to call. In summary judgment, the defendant actually bears the burden to show that we have no case. And they have to do that by actually creating record evidence to show the court that, well, they can claim that there is no evidence. I'm sorry, Judge.
I was just saying that was the issue in Celotex. If they have the burden of proof and they want summary judgment, they certainly have to develop evidence. But they can come in and say, we don't think you can prove knowledge, if knowledge is a critical element, or we don't think you can prove causation, or we don't think you can prove whatever it is. And if they have pointed to the flaw in the plaintiff's case, Celotex says they've discharged what they needed to do. And the onus of moving forward moves over to the party with the burden of proof, here the plaintiff.
Right. And I guess I would just respond to that by saying the issue of when the statements were made to the guard on the chair where Rodman was working was not really an issue in the district court, because what they actually raised was that there's no evidence to suggest Rodman's liability at all. And they didn't even cite the affidavit of Michael Williams that was presented to them. They don't cite any of the prisoner testimony in the district court briefing. They just ignored the issue altogether and sought to shift the burden by making what was really an inaccurate claim that there was no record evidence. They just didn't try to discover it. To some extent, we have the same issue when we talk about Hammersley's liability, because here you have life and death letters that she received that alerted her to the fact that, Amanda Smith, Mr. Frederickson's treater at Shawnee, who she spoke to, described these letters as effectively a suicide note. You have Dr. Burns, our expert, saying they're effectively a suicide note. And Hammersley denied that, and that's fine. She denies knowing that it was suicide, but that these letters were about suicide. But she knew that he was at least in extreme emotional distress, and she met with the warden, and they decided to do nothing about it.
Mr. Casaglad, I'd like to focus in on this transfer from the second prison to the third prison. Does the record reveal why Mr. Fredrickson was transferred from Jacksonville to Pinckneyville? Was it no substance abuse as a result of the needle in the shoe? What was the reason for that, I think it was June 17 transfer, if the record shows?
I don't think that there is any evidence as to why he got transferred out of some segregation at Jacksonville to segregation at Pinckneyville. But the needle, I think, was some kind of handcuff key, they alleged, right? It wasn't like a drug needle, was my understanding. But
well, the reason why I raise it is the temporal sequence. So June 3rd, he arrives at Jacksonville. June 8th and June 10th, he writes these letters. June 17th, he gets transferred. June 27th is the date of the suicide. So one of the letters, I think he makes reference to the fact that he does not want to do hard prison or real prison. Is there some type of a distinction here between the prisons with regard to the treatment he would be getting or the programming he would be getting?
I mean, Pinckneyville is sort of well known for abuse. I mean, I think that you see in the record in this case that prisoners were actually being tortured in the bathroom on the tier that Mr. Fredrickson was staying at, and one of them had committed suicide a week earlier. So, I think that that's what he was referring to when he said he was afraid of going to Pinckneyville. It does kind of lead into this problem and the sequence of events that Wexford Health Sources has, which is that there's no policies set up to deal with the intrasystem transfer process. And a severely mentally ill inmate transferring from one prison to another, it's obvious that they're going to need continuous, complex, coordinated care between their treaters. It's not okay to just ship them out and then the people at the new facilities at Jacksonville and at Pinckneyville have no idea that he was just taken off suicide watch. He's given no medical treatment for 25 days, despite the fact that he was just suicidal. And that is not just tragic. I mean, that's unconstitutional.
It strikes me as an overstatement to say no medical treatment if he was receiving his medications, though.
And I do distinguish that in the brief. He received no medical treatment except for his medications. So the medications were delivered. So I apologize for that.
And the medications were pretty clearly, to anyone in the medical field, these were psychotropic medications, right? And they clearly list them in the brief. That's what they were.
Clearly. They're psychotropic medications, and they clearly indicate that this man is severely mentally ill. And a lot of the jail population, which is part of the facts of the record, at Pinckneyville is mentally ill and severely mentally ill. This is not an uncommon problem for them to deal with, which is why it raises questions about why none of the staff at Pinckneyville knew that he had this problem. And Wexford doesn't even try to explain that. You know, they don't try to distinguish our argument that Dixon applies to this case where you have a widespread inaccurate medical records. They don't even cite the Glisson decision in their brief or try to rebut it.
Well, I mean, there's some distinctions here, but I want to go back. I mean, this woman, Debbie Webb, by this time, is he at Pinckneyville yet? I guess he's still at Jackson. She does a mental health evaluation, accurately records that he's been on crisis watch, accurately notes suicidal ideation and all of that. And that information goes along to Pinckneyville, June 17. And LPN, and Murray both evaluate suicide potential. But they write yes. They write two times in response to whether there have been previous suicide attempts, so they know it.
Well, there's information that they gather once they're there, but what happens is the offender medical problem list, which is the document the witnesses testify they rely on to look at whether or not what kind of problems these inmates suffer, do not have these problems listed on it. And that's undisputed. So they're sending around these inaccurate medical records, and that's where you have this report by Dr. Shansky and Dr. Stewart pointing out that this is the way the intra-transfer system works on a widespread basis. There is no accurate information. There is no being transmitted on a widespread basis. So they don't have the necessary tools they need. I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, so I may have run out, but I thank the court. And
thank you, counsel. You have 6 seconds remaining. Ms. Fritz.
May it please the court. My name is Abby Fritz, and I represent the appellee Wexford Health Sources Incorporated. I just want to start off by saying that Quinn admittedly waived any argument related to the individual Wexford defendants, and therefore there's no argument remaining that's right for the court as to any individual Wexford employees. This is significant because Quinn does not therefore dispute the district court's ruling that no individual Wexford employee acted with deliberate indifference, which is also consistent with Quinn's own expert, Dr. Burns, who said that she has no criticisms of the individual Wexford employees and that there is no evidence that they deviated from the standard of care. Now, as to Wexford, the district court properly determined that there's no genuine issue of material fact left in this case. And given that, the district court also properly determined that there's insufficient evidence to demonstrate that any policy or procedure, or as plaintiff alleges, gaps related thereto, were the moving force behind Fredrickson's suicide.
So, Ms. Fritz, could you outline for me what policies were in place? They don't necessarily have to. I mean, if IDOC has a policy, I'll presume Wexford knows about that. Everybody doesn't have to repeat every policy. But what policies were in place to assure continuity of care in these transfers?
Okay. Yes, of course, Your Honor. First of all, I would like to point out that plaintiff's argument that there were no policies and procedures in place is wholly incorrect. As you can tell, and it's been in the record, Wexford first follows IDOC policies and procedures. And if there are any gaps related thereto, Wexford's policies and procedures will supplement. Now, in this case, and actually in all cases, anytime there is a transfer of an inmate, whether that be related to medical or mental health issues, the transfer summary is to be completed first by the transferring facility. Then it is received by the receiving facility and filled out there. In addition, anytime an inmate is transferred, or actually anytime an inmate is received in a facility, they must have an evaluation of suicide potential. And that is also a policy or procedure. Now, in addition to that,
these are written down somewhere. This got put in the record or testified to, or how do we know this?
These are testified to. Specifically, I can say that they're testified to in Ms. Hammersley's deposition. I can give you some of the citations if you would like to her deposition regarding the mental health evaluations, the suicide potential, what needs to be filled out, and within that time frame.
I can look at the deposition. That's fine. Okay.
For example, the mental health evaluation needs to be completed within 14 days of an inmate being added to the mental health caseload. For example, when at Pinckneyville, as you can see, that qualified mental health professional, Stacey Murray, she completed the evaluation of suicide potential, which did include that plaintiff admitted he had had 2 suicide attempts, including one this year. So she was aware that he had a previous mental health history, including attempted suicide, but she added him to the mental health caseload. That was on June 18th. Unfortunately, Mr. Fredrickson committed suicide in the very early morning of June 27th. So that was less than 14 days, approximately 10 days, little less. Therefore, he was not there within that time frame that they're allotted to complete. And based on the evaluations by Nancy Canope when she did the intake screening and by Ms. Murray, that there was no indication that he needed expedited treatment, that he was of an immediate suicide risk. In addition, if you look at the transfer summary, it clearly shows he's on psychotropic medication. It shows that he had a history of suicide. It also shows that he has history of mental health disorders, including anxiety disorders. Therefore, it's unclear what plaintiff would have you add to that that is fully necessary to have prevented Mr. Fredrickson's suicide, which is why the key here is that there is no evidence presented by Ms. Quinn that any additional policies or procedures or any changes in the policies or procedures would have altered the course of events in this case. And that is critical. This court in 2019 in the Gabb case indicated that a plaintiff has failed to meet their burden of proof whenever there is no indication that any course of treatment would have alleviated the problem. And that is analogous to this case. Therefore, that is the insurmountable flaw in plaintiff's case. Plaintiff would like to focus on the policies and procedures themselves and ignore the fact that they have to have a connection. They have to be that moving force in Mr. Fredrickson's suicide. Additionally, Your Honors, I would like to point out that a big issue with mental health and an opposite to medical treatment is that mental health revolves around recency. Plaintiff's own expert, Dr. Burns, stated that somebody can be suicidal one day or even 1 hour and not be suicidal the next. In addition, she's also said that there's a degree of ambivalence and that once somebody makes up their mind, it's almost impossible to stop that suicide. And it's clear in the record and outlined in our brief regarding plaintiff's cellmate, Mr. Kane, plaintiff had a clear plan to commit suicide in this case. And although tragic, there is no evidence that that could have been prevented by any changes in policies or procedures. Additionally, Your Honor, I do want to bring up a little bit about the Glisson and the Dixon case, as plaintiff pointed out in his opening. First of all, with Dixon, that case is clearly distinguishable because not only does it involve medical, again, which is significant distinction, but in the Dixon case, there were medical records, but they were not scanned in. They were not readily available to the provider. So even though the provider knew that medical records existed, they had no ability to access them. That is not evidence in this case. In this case, there is evidence that the medical and mental health records, which again, Dr. Burns has stated were complete, that there was nothing significant missing from those mental health records, that those were transferred to Jacksonville and then subsequently to Pinckneyville. So the providers on site did have the ability to look at those records, which is distinguishable from Dixon. In regards to Glisson, Glisson is important for a very specific reason. In Glisson, the defendant, which was Corizon, they admitted that they didn't have any policies or procedures in place. Rather, they went solely by the standard of care, which, as this court stated, resulted in a total lack of uncoordinated care. Again, that's not the case here. The transfer summaries, that is a policy or procedure that was in place and was completed in this case, which contained all the relevant information or a summary of the relevant information related to Mr. Fredrickson's mental health, enough to put the individuals on notice at each facility that he had mental health issues and to maybe dig deeper in those evaluations of suicide potential. Again, in no instance was it evident that he needed expedited or immediate mental health assistance. And that is something that Dr. Burns did not disagree with. She said that the Wexford, she was not critical of the actions by any of the Wexford defendants in this case. Your Honors, in conclusion, plaintiff's argument is akin to the principle of res ipsa loquitur or even strict liability. Although tragic that Mr. Fredrickson did commit suicide within the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections, it does not automatically equate to liability. As the courts previously stated in Section 1983 claims, including Monell claims, that there is a very high burden of proof, which in this case, plaintiff has not met. Therefore, we rest our case on our briefs and oral argument, and we request that you affirm the district court's judgment in favor of Wexford. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fritz. Ms. Buell.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Caitlin Buell on behalf of state defendants Kristen Hammersley and Alexander Rodman. While this is an unfortunate case because it involves an inmate suicide, the question here is whether the undisputed facts met the high standard for deliberate indifference under the Eighth Amendment. Deliberate indifference is more than negligence. To hold a defendant liable for deliberate indifference, the plaintiff must show that he faced an objectively serious harm to his health or his safety, and that the defendant was subjectively aware of that risk and intentionally disregarded it. In the context of an inmate suicide, the plaintiff must show that the defendant was subjectively aware of an imminent risk of suicide and disregarded that risk. State defendants move for summary judgment based on a lack of subjective awareness to Fredrickson's suicide risk. Quinn, as the non-movement and the executor of this estate, had the burden to come forward with specific facts showing that state defendants were subjectively aware of Fredrickson's imminent risk of suicide. And based on this record, Quinn failed to meet her burden with respect to each state defendant. The record does not show that Rodman was subjectively aware of any suicide risk. And under this court's decision in Matos, a prison official cannot be subjectively indifferent to a risk of suicide if the inmate never makes that risk known to the official.
So what about, maybe you can respond to Mr. Kozelglad's argument that other inmates were willing to testify that they heard Mr. Fredrickson calling out for help after the 10 o'clock or around the time of the 10 o'clock check.
Your Honor, the affidavit of Mr. Williams actually does not state a time specifically when the inmates were calling out or when a request was made. And the record also doesn't contain anything from which to infer that Mr. Rodman overheard any requests for aid, any noises, how big the wing is, how many levels the wing is, where anything was, or the timing. And so all we have here is that Rodman, as discussed on page 52 of his deposition, never discussed any mental health issues with Mr. Fredrickson or received any request for help from him. Similarly, Hammersley was not subjectively aware of Fredrickson's current suicide risk. She was the social worker at Fredrickson's first prison, Shawnee, and after he was transferred, she sent a detailed email about his mental health care and his recent crisis watch to Jacksonville, his second facility. She then had no further involvement in his care. When she received a fax from his mother containing letters from Fredrickson, she saw them, in her professional opinion, as a request for help and an advocate concerning segregation status, not a suicide note or a life-changing letter. She also took affirmative steps concerning the segregation request by promptly reporting these letters to her assistant warden.
Of course, the letters are ambiguous. I mean, there's a tone of desperation in those letters.
Hammersley did note on page 8 of the document containing her deposition that it was indeed he was anxious. He was clearly very upset, but overall she thought it was a request for help with the segregation status and staying at Jacksonville, where there was mental health and drug treatment, which was his stated goal, and was asking for assistance in that with her assistant warden. She, in her professional opinion, did not see this as a suicide risk. And this shows action, not indifference. Because neither state defendant was subjectively aware of the risk, we would ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment. But if this court were to find a constitutional violation here, it would indicate a change in and a lowering of the standard for deliberate indifference under the Eighth Amendment that would entitle state defendants to qualified immunity. If there are no further questions, we would ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kozelglad, anything further? I will round your 6 seconds up to 1 minute. It's a factor.
Thank you, Judge. Willie White says, told the investigators that it was at 10 o'clock. He's the witness who said the timing. I just checked our brief on that. Jody Legasse says it was around 10:30. So there's that evidence in the record. And as far as the, but I guess with just 1 minute, I'll just rest on the arguments I previously made. I have nothing further to add. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.